Ramsey TV.
I'd like to start this show by publicly thanking Chris Stegall for an amazing gift package that he sent here. Chris, I'm going to be sending you a personal email here very soon, but wow, what a blessing for a weary soldier. Thank you very much for that. Greetings, everyone. This is Martin Sender from the edge of the bottom of the Floridan Peninsula. I'm going to do something a little different today. First, I'm going to tell you, there's three books going to be coming out. Boom, boom, boom. I'm waiting till I get each one like 95% done, and then I'm going to close the door on all of them. The one I've talked to you about earlier, it's about Christianity's version of the Third Reich. I can't even remember the name of that book, but you remember, I drew the comparison. Oh, Christianity's Final Solution, comparing the doctrine of eternal torment to the final solution of the Nazi regime. And it's an apt comparison. I made some shows on that, if you recall. That book's 95% done. I'm just toying with them all. I'm getting close. The other book is How to Love Anyone, Even Your Spouse. This is a book on love. Very helpful for marriages and such. I could say a lot about it now, but I'll wait for that. It's also 95% done. Here's the big deal right here. Seth Vollenkamp and I have been working on Volume 1 of the Romans series. It's going to be a four-volume mega writing on Romans. As you know, I published in my newsletter, ZWTF, over a period of 3.5 years, 156 parts on the book of Romans, a commentary. No verse left uncommented upon. It's, if I don't mind saying so, I mean, it's just epic. I'm reading this stuff for the first time in a long time. And it just shines forth. The life, the love, the life of Christ, the love of God shines forth. It's Volume 1. Romans is handily divided into four parts of four chapters. So Volume 1 is called Zender on Romans. Volume 1 is chapters 1 through 4. Volume 2, 5 through 8. Volume 3, however it goes, 9 to 12. And the Volume 4, 13 through 16. The amount of work, I mean, the writing was easy compared to the amount of work it is taking to get this in a volume. It's going to be big. It's going to be as big as the Lie of Every Man's Battle as far as the heft of the book. There's a lot of writing there. But I'd love to give you an idea of how long it's going to take to get all four volumes out. But we're going to publish Volume 1, you know, right away. We're not going to wait till we have all four volumes published before we put this out. But what I'm going to do today is I'm going to read you an excerpt from chapter 24, and it's the two most important words I have ever learned in Romans, and it's in 3:21, yet now. Paul has spent chapter 1, verse 18, through chapter 3, verse 20, speaking eloquently and really depressingly on the inability of humanity to attain God. He's just smashing everybody down. He first takes on the man of the world. Then he takes on the religious man. And he winds up with, there's no one righteous, no, not one. Not one is understanding, not one is seeking God. All have sinned and are wanting of the glory of God. I mean, it's just, I call it in this book, I call it the decimation. Capital T, capital D, the decimation, because Paul is decimating the entire human race. And if you didn't know any better, I mean, it's part of the gospel. It's not the positive announcement of it, but until you know the negatives, you can't appreciate the positive announcement of it. So Paul is setting the stage to close every mouth. I've said this to you many times. He's got to close every mouth. He's got to shut up everybody into complete silence, so that the symphony of the accomplishment of Christ can begin. There can't be any jibber-jabbering about, well, maybe I'm worthy. No, wait, I did this, I did that. Paul just smashes everyone flat. And everyone's just forlorn and despairing. And then Paul administers the remedy. in Romans 3:21, and he begins it with, yet now, apart from law, a righteousness of God is manifest. And I didn't realize how important those words were until I heard Dean Huff say them at a conference in Little Chapel in Baldwin, Michigan, hosted by Dorothy and Lloyd Hibbard. Went there many times with my family. Baldwin, Michigan. Look it up on the map. Little tiny town way up north. Little tiny, tiny chapel. We would go there in August, and we would go there in October for 3 days of meetings. And it was here, probably 1994, when I heard Dean Huff say these amazing words. But it's a way that he did it. Now, I don't know if I'm going to get through this today. I would love to. Let's see how it goes and how I feel. But in this book, in chapter 24, the name of this chapter is Nothing Frightened Christ More. And that, speaking of death, we're saved, the death, the entombment, and the resurrection of Christ. In the first part of this chapter, I go into detail about the chapel, set the stage. And then, here it comes. And it was here, on this ordinary day in August, that I heard Dean Huff of the Concordant Publishing Concern, editor of Unsearchable Riches magazine, a modern-day Paul in his own right, say two words that changed my life. Yet now. He paused and then said them again. He was teaching from Romans and had found his place in chapter 3, settling on the 21st verse. Here he was, Dean Huff, at chapter 3 and verse 21 of the letter Paul wrote to straighten out everything in our troubled minds. Dean paused and he said it again. Yet now. Why did he say it again? I wondered. What of it? Then he said it again. At the third repetition, I felt it. Something had just changed, both in Romans and in my heart. Something was changing in my understanding. Something had changed in the voice of this latest Paul. The tenor of everything had just taken a turn. My future with God had veered off into a glorious avenue laden with stars. God's opinion of me was about to be articulated from a man of no articulation. Speaking of Dean Huff, but also probably the Apostle Paul. No great articulation, no orators, these men simply stating the words of God. Something was coming that would alter the dual enemies of sin and death forever. Everything that had gone before in this important letter, there was no one righteous, no, not one, now turned dramatically with two simple words plainly uttered. Yet now. Shocking was Dean's utter monotone. Shocking was the way the words hit without finesse or fanfare. True to Paul, Dean simply said them. The words themselves held the power. The gospel is the power of God. The saying of the gospel is the power of the heart of the deity. It is logos, the expression. The words alone change everything. Dean knew this, and Paul before him knew it very well. It took three repetitions, each as dull as the last, each as blaring. How would I miss this? How could I just now be hearing such truth? How could I have read Romans so many times and missed the import? Yet now, apart from law, a righteousness of God is manifested. Nothing going before in Romans had stitch or stammer to do with God's righteousness. No, it was all about my failure to attain it. The words before concerned the inability of human beings to attain to God's divine standard. Everything heretofore contributed to humanity hanging high and dry without a single hope or expectation in this world. We speak incessantly of the nations having no expectation and without God in the world. You can find that verse, Ephesians 2:12. But Paul has just set the nations and Israel adrift in the same boat of doom. There's no one righteous, no, not one. Yet now. Forget how we never saw such a thing. The question now is, how do we see it? We simply turn our heads away from our own failures and toward Christ. What could be easier? And yet, what could be more difficult? We turn our heads and eyes from our own darkened hearts toward the stake set so firmly into the earth and to the man suffering and dying upon it. Thus engaged, we behold something so different, so strange to our sight, so foreign to anything we could imagine for ourselves, that we can't take our eyes from it. We have looked within for the righteousness of God each time, coming away empty. The disappointment has vexed us, tortured us, and nearly killed us. Unaccountably, we've repeated and repeated the failure. Ah, but yet now. Yet now a righteousness of God is manifest. Oh my God, then show me the righteousness of God. Who would not want to see this? What human being, hearing the very possibility announced, could refrain from gazing upon something so marvelous as the righteousness of Him who created us all? Could it resemble anything we've ever seen? How do we see it? Through what glasses do we behold it? In what light will it come to us? What, if anything, stands between us and it? Surely something vast and dark. Who is so at home and comfortable with his or her own struggles and failures that he or she would focus inwardly rather than outwardly at the promise of such a marvel? Who would refuse the announcement of something so new, so startling, so ultra-human? Strangely, it greets us without fanfare or earthly flourish, but rather with two simple words. The two words, so easily overlooked by flesh, are latched upon by the Spirit as though they are life itself. And they are. Yet now a righteousness of God is manifest. Yes, I want this. Show me the righteousness of God, if only I can see it. It must be something so different from my own righteousness. Please, God, if I cannot look of my own accord, then you turn my head and give me eyes fit to see the new spectacle. I'm tired of myself, my failures, my efforts to please you rusted shut. I'm so frustrated that I will look at anything now. Ah, you have set me up brilliantly for this. The years of futility have prepared me for your next sentence, whatever strange thing it will be. You have situated me just so. Now divert me. I badly want it. And it happens. Yet now, a righteousness of God is manifest, yet a righteousness of God through Jesus Christ's faith. I behold now a man on a stake dying. Oh my God, I see Jesus Christ alone, nailed to a crude stake, struggling for breath. Why is he doing this? I start to cry. My first cry is, why must an innocent man suffer so much? My first instinct is to avert my eye, to rebel against a new thing. It's so foreign to me. Yet for some reason unexplained, I cannot look away. Because now, from the stake of torture, the man speaks. From the Roman tool of execution, the sufferer forgives his murderers. Father, forgive them. I haven't time to recover from it when he begins talking to his God. How can he utter any words at all? My eyes are open, and now I see the invisible demons tormenting him. From ground level, the priests mock him. His mother is crying. He looks upon her with tenderness. Through strained breath, he's suffocating to death. He tells John to love her unto the end of her days. From the stake, he cares for others. Now he requests drink. His words are barely discernible. He jerks his hands suddenly. The nails there vex him in a new way. He bites his lip at it, drawing new blood. He's crying now. His mother now must turn away. Tears flow from his brown eyes with no one to catch them. I turn away myself. When I turn back, the horror has morphed into calm. What is it? He then says, it is finished. He's doing something. Something is happening right now. Something that has never happened before. Yet nothing in the world looks different. Roman soldiers still spit and mumble, kicking the dust. But I feel it. And now I see it. Or my spirit feels it within me. It is something so large and yet so silent as to make anyone wonder whether anything at all has occurred. Not a soul present here, save him and me, discern it. The spirit world surrounds him, both good and evil. They know. Not even he can physically see it, and yet, in this moment, it is accomplished. What is accomplished? God himself is smiting his son. His own father is behind it. It's true. His father is behind everything. Who is torturing him at the stake? His father is. His own father is using other people. The other people are all vessels of dishonor. Satan, Israel, the priests, the Romans with the sponge on the stick, Judas, now dead, Pontius Pilate, Herod. How can he settle into this? How can he justify it in his mind? He knows something. Now he cries out to his father, my God, why have you forsaken me? This starts me crying hard. He feels forsaken. I can no longer look. His mother has long since bowed her face to the ground, her grief coming in spasms, racking her shoulders in John's grip. All his life he knew fellowship with his father. Now this. Now even his father has left him alone, forsaken him. Or so it feels. The sky turns black, but it's midday. People become afraid. A surge of wind strikes. It has portents in it. Even the Romans executing him now become nervous. What have they done? They look at one another, but say nothing. It is finished. Then the light comes to my spirit, even though the unnatural darkness drives Satan himself to a far corner of creation to hide from what he has done. The Son is faithful to the will of his Father. His Father sent him here not because of his hatred for the world, but because of his love for it. Can the world detect the love of one invisible? Yes, but only through a visible man perfectly representing him. A man with nails driven through his wrists and feet. A man who loves those killing him, and who is now reconciling even the malevolent perpetrator, adrift now, hiding his face. Father, forgive them. I thirst. It is finished. It renders us fixed. This is far beyond anything familiar to us. Satan himself could not have imagined it. If he had known, he would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Or would he have? What the world at large cannot now know is that this man has for 6 hours been assuming and battling the sins of the world, and not those of the known world only, but the failings of an unseen realm high above Jerusalem. And not only the sins of humanity he fights, but those of invisible celestial beings who themselves must learn the love of his Father. Is such a thing now accomplished? Yes, but not by the might of sword or sweat, but rather through loving sacrifice. It is not by grandeur, but by grace. He knows he's going to die. As I watch, he prepares himself for his last breath. His Father has promised not to forsake him in the unseen. He once doubted his Father, but not now. He's finally through the 6 hours. Like Jonah in the belly of the great fish, this man will be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and 3 nights. This is the picture his father gave him, the picture, the sign of Jonah. When it first occurred to him, he didn't like it. He would think about Jonah, then drove it from his mind, yet it always revisited. Again and again, the example of Jonah came to him. He knew why he could not stop thinking about it. It was the answer. It was not only his fate, but his deliverance. God delivered Jonah from the belly of the darkness. It wasn't much to go on, but it was something. Thus, his father promised to deliver him from 3 days of death. He himself raised Lazarus. He knew the power of his God. The problem was that he himself had never tasted it. Death. It was one thing to raise other people, quite another to taste death for oneself. All things human had become his experience, except this. It was the last thing, the hardest thing. Nothing was more bitter. Nothing frightened him more. He knew that when he gave up his spirit and his head fell to his chest, he would cease to exist. Our Lord knew nothing of the Trinity. He knew what he was, the firstborn of the creation of God, God's Son. As God's Son and as the ultimate sacrifice for the ultimate failure of everything, he must taste this hardest thing. He must not exist. He must taste death for all, then trust his Father to raise him. It was all on the trust, the faith. All he had to go on was the few people he himself had raised. And Jonah. The stupid saga of Jonah. He knew what it meant to say the words, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." It is why he drew such a large breath. His last thoughts were of Jonah. Then it was over. He did what he wondered if he could ever do. He gave up his spirit to his father. The decimation would be 3 days, or 30 days, or 3,000 years. There would be no experience for him. No passage of time, nothing. The dead do not know anything, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 5. If his father did not rouse him, at least he would never know of the failure, of the breach of trust. He would now enter oblivion to destroy oblivion. Yet a righteousness of God through Jesus Christ's faith. It was Jesus Christ's faith in giving himself up to the plan of God for us that demonstrates to us the righteousness of God. The most righteous thing a human being or any being can do is to believe God. None of us believe God. We have all gone out of the way. We have all become useless. There is no one righteous, no, not one. There is no one who believes God, but he believed God. He believed God in the worst extremity. God appointed him to be the representative man, that is, the answer to Adam. He believed God for all of us. We could not do it. Because of him, all those in Adam will one day come from death forever. Since he is the answer to Adam, then his belief is our belief. God cannot express this faithfulness himself. He is invisible. Jesus Christ is his visible image. 2 Corinthians 4:4. Through Jesus Christ, God demonstrates his own faithfulness. If God could demonstrate his faithfulness to us unto death, he would. But God cannot die. Therefore, he sends his Son to die, not only for us, but in the stead of God himself. It is as though God, through him, dies for us. It is as though God is saying, "I am doing this for you. I would do it for you," so literally, but I am not a man and therefore cannot be extinguished. "Yet I send to you my most precious possession, my only Son. Through him, you see my heart. Through his obedience in being extinguished, you see my faithfulness to you, to everything I promised you. Through his belief in me and through his trust in me, you see my belief and my trust in my plans and in my love for you." All of this is demonstrated at the cross of Christ. We are saved not by our faith, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. So take your eyes from your own faith, for it will fail you at every turn. Take your eyes from the weakness of your own belief, which vacillates like the sea. Cast your weakness upon His faithfulness in dying for His Father and His Father's plan. It's the last thing He wanted to do in the flesh, yet the most desirable thing of His inner heart. It was the hardest thing God ever asked of Him, yet the only thing He had to do. Through it, He proves every promise of God to be true. Even though His Father smote Him, He yet trusted in Him. And His Father raised Him from the dead. Extend this love heavenward into the bosom of the Father, because everything Christ did is a picture and testament to the faithfulness of God toward us. Yet now, a righteousness of God is manifest. Cast your eyes upon the cross. It is your answer. It is what God sees. It is the remedy to everything at which you have ever failed.